718 here at WOTW. We got a sound we'd like to play that seems to be bouncing around the valley tonight.
We're looking for a solution to this. Not this.
Listen, brothers and sisters, listen, listen, listen. Can you hear the bells ring out? Speak now. Speak now.
We sigh into the onslaught of identical days. One might as well. The sun goes up and down like a tired whore, while you just keep getting older.
At least you have each other. Nothing worse than going through this shit alone.
You made another like me, but better.
Different.
Better. Just like I'm better than my sister.
My dad used to say, what's remembered lives. I maybe spent too much of my life just remembering.
I'm concerned you have to think about it.
Give me a moment, would you, friend? I've never been on trial for my thoughts before.
Your partner's threatened or frightened you? Never? Rarely? Sometimes? Always?
Why are you asking me this?
He's a good guy.
Sure. It's nature. Males are forced to fight, to dominate, and to impregnate all females.
I am a nice guy.
Are you?
1, 2, 3, 4. Come on and turn your back on me! Come on, we're just scared up! Turn your back on me! Come on!
I dedicate this next record to the Soul Brothers of the 1st Infantry Divisions. Be safe.
Every action, act of creation. I'm laughing in the face of casualties and sorrow. For the first time, I'm thinking past tomorrow.
Pod, a Third Two Fans podcast, where we discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name, as always, remains Sammy Chester.
And I'm Av Sinensky, and welcome back to our second annual Best Movie of the Year bracket. This is the 2020 / kind of 2021 bracket, and today we will be covering 33 movies, because we have 32 plus a play-in, to determine the official podcast movie of the year. Just like last year, the 33 movies have been selected from a panel of experts, by which I mean the two of us, plus we've included critically acclaimed movies, even if those that didn't necessarily make it into our top movies of the year. So we hope that we will have good cross-section of the biggest, best, and most discussed movies of the year, leading up to crowning what will be the official There Will Be Pod 2020 movie of the year.
This is not my top 32. I don't think it's Av's top 32. Hopefully we'll both share our own later. As astute listeners may notice, last year at this time, Av, there were three hosts of There Will Be Pod. And this year, we currently have two hosts.
I think we're just going to have to agree on everything or else we're going to be in a problem.
Yes. So we may end up having 32 movies tie for number one movie of the year, which maybe would be a 2020 fitting conclusion. For tiebreakers, we're going to do it old school style, boys state style, meaning backroom negotiation, using listener contributions where we can. But we'll figure out our number one way or the other. You know, I think a lot of listeners know that we've done a lot of brackets on this pod. As Av said, it's our second annual best of the year, but I have no idea. Is this our 32nd bracket maybe we've done?
I don't know. We did a lot of sports brackets.
Yeah.
Sports movies brackets.
The purpose of this episode is really to celebrate the past year in movies alongside our, you know, friends and fans. Naming a winner, the whole bracket, all of that is just a way to do so. And so it's really a celebration of the year 2020 in movies, which I would like to jump right into, Av, because I recall a year ago on this podcast, you had said that you would frame 2019 as having an excellent crop of elite movies, but the second tier was sort of underwhelming. What do you make of 2020?
I would say that this year, I think, is probably the exact opposite. I don't have my 2019 list in front of me, but I remember the top three or five off the top of my head. And at least that group of five, there is nothing from this year that I think touches that. And it's possible that there's really nothing from this year that would even make my top 10 in last year. But I do think there is a deep bench in terms of very good movies. There's probably like 20 or 30 of those, but no real like elite all-timers for me so far.
I saw 90 movies this year. 40 of those movies were great time, would recommend them to almost anyone, but none of these would touch my top five from a typical movie year. I'm not someone who usually puts in my top five the big tentpole movies. So I'm not quite sure why 2020 had, you know, a weaker crop of indies per se.
That aside, was there a common thread to this year's movies?
I would say there were a lot of female-centered movies this year.
Yes.
I don't know if that is... Sometimes there's a little bit of a delay on the artistic side for social developments to really make their way into the pop culture. So you could certainly understand if like it took a few years for the Me Too movement and the kind of the backlash to the Trump presidency to really find its way into the movies. And obviously, the suburban woman specifically, but just, you know, women in general have been very much at the center of both like the political and cultural talk of the last 4 to 5 years. And I think that's probably demonstrated itself in a big way in the movies that came out in 2020.
When we had an episode early in the year, we looked back at, you know, what are the best movies for the first quarter, I think it was, of 2020. At the time we had said for movies about women, I would say the second half cemented a lot of female directed movies. So again, it's not just movies that are about women, but, you know, you'll see, and I think Av and I, as we go through this bracket, will highlight who are the directors and the stars of these movies. There's a lot of female directors behind movies that, you know, may only have men on screen. For instance, One Night in Miami, best example of that.
Certainly a lot of movies about people of color, and The Five Bloods specifically addresses that. The Steve McQueen Small Act anthology is about protest movements. There's a lot of what we're seeing out in the real world has been trickling in to the movies of 2020. I don't know if it just took a few years for that kind of to really swell up to the top, but you know, even when I was making my best of list, and I, with any sort of intention, I found that a lot of the movies at the very top of my list fell into those categories.
When I was asking if they wanted to contribute any audio to this bracket, a bunch of people who normally I would say see anywhere from 20 to 60, you know, maybe new releases a year, were like, I dropped off the new release bandwagon this year. I saw Hamilton, I saw that Borat sequel, and I don't know if I saw much beyond that. Why do you think that is? Is it that people are drawn to the tentpole movies? Is it that people are drawn to the theater? And without a theater, everything is streaming. And if everything is streaming, then what's the difference between a new release or just an old movie you haven't seen before? How do you explain sort of the drop off from the new release bandwagon? Because, you know, our pod is mainly about new releases.
You know, when something is out in theaters, whether you see it in theater or not, it becomes culturally relevant for at least some period of time that then kind of either prompts you to go see it in the theater or at least put it on your list or, you know, in the back of your mind to something to see when it does hit streaming. When everything just kind of gets dumped on streaming, it just goes in the pile with everything else that's ever existed. And there's so much out there, new, old, in between. It's hard to convince someone that like they need to go see The Assistant.
I actually think extended series, whether Small Arcs falls into that or not, but certainly, you know, the TV shows we're seeing, I think those better take advantage of what streaming is. There's more of a hook for something which is going to be a series. It allows sort of the media to feed on it in sort of a recurrent way rather than a one-off movie, which doesn't really, in the streaming context, you know, engage people as much. So I think that's part of it. But, you know, that's something, I'm by no means an expert. I'm just sort of, you know, a very casual watcher. Don't think movies as a whole, and then as you were saying, new releases in particular, I don't think they stand to benefit as much. because of COVID or whatnot, the way that movies are sort of shifting, the rise of streaming.
Like a lot of things with coronavirus, it has accelerated the pace of trends that already existed in, you know, various markets, whether the seeming collapse of movie theaters have been witnessing, and I think we will continue to see, unless the Wall Street Bets Reddit has anything to say about that.
I have one request of, and I don't know if you'll meet me halfway or reject me outright.
Denied.
Denied before I even begin.
That's right.
I'm going to at least put it out there, and you and the listeners will take as you will. Every single movie review I feel I've read this year or podcast I listen to, always looking to draw comparisons and parallels between the movies that came out this year and the reality of 2020. And my point is that 2020 is one of the most remarkable years that any of us have ever undergone, largely obviously for the challenges that transpired, and we'll remember it the rest of our lives. There's a tendency to try to force movies, as you had said, particularly that they were made in 2018 and maybe inspired by things that happened even before then, into, oh, they are now speaking the current zeitgeist. And there's so many movies in this bracket that maybe lend themselves to that. So my one request is that we don't do too much of that. My one request is we don't try to kind of frame every single movie we speak about as saying, like, this really captured the 2020 experience. This was the movie of 2020 because it captured Corona and it captured protests and it captured authoritarian president, etc. I understand the tendency to want to do that. It's almost unfair to the movie. It's almost unfair to the artistic creation, which outside of maybe a Sacha Baron Cohen or arguably sort of a Spike Lee, though I think, you know, he kind of adjusted the release of The Five Bloods to take advantage of growing BLM, which obviously had been growing for years. I don't think most of these movies as artistic creations were necessarily made by their creators to speak to people locked down at home. So I don't know if you think that's a request worth respecting, or as you said at the beginning, you're going to deny it out.
I guess we'll see what happens. Yeah, I don't think there's too many that need to be specifically tied to quarantine. Trump is always tricky because, like, if you squint hard enough, you could connect pretty much everything to Trump because he's just, like, so larger than life and all-encompassing and stuck himself into every single aspect of life for the last 5 years. That is almost any movie you could watch and be like, oh, I think this movie is about Donald Trump. Yeah, we'll try to avoid that and just focus on the movies in a vacuum to the extent possible.
I appreciate that. Okay, well, last question before we get started. What was your 33rd favorite movie of the year? The movie that was left out of this bracket.
Give you two movies that I really enjoyed that were left off. One of them is a movie we talked about on the podcast. I think that was like our first feature of the year was Bad Education, the HBO movie about the cheating scandal on Long Island at a high-end school. The other movie that I really enjoyed was Freaky, the Changing Bodies Vince Vaughn movie.
I would give two as well. Literally my 33rd favorite movie of the year is The Trip to Greece, which I've spoken about a few times. If you like British humor and you like sort of travel dialogues, it's a wonderful movie to check out. Something is the sequel times five. Is it the Quantical?
Quintology.
The Quintology, yeah. So that was literally my 33rd. But the movie that jumps out, because it's my top five of the year, and I didn't insist we put it in the bracket simply because it just felt a bit too foreign maybe for most people's sake. Though I think when I made the case for it in our first episode of 2020, I had said, if this movie was in English starring, you know, American actors, I think it would be lauded as one of the very best as of March. And that is The Wild Goose Lake, which is a Chinese noir gangster movie that just has incredible camera and lighting. Plot can be a little hard to follow at times, I'll give you that. And it's set in Wuhan, China. The movie was made 5 years ago. So it was set in Wuhan, China before people cared about Wuhan, China per se. But The Wild Goose Lake, I would urge people, again, top five for me in a year of movies I liked. So Wild Goose Lake, pretty special. Are you ready for some brackets?
I am ready. Are you?
Suggest that per tradition, we start with Jim Crumley. His number one was probably the movie that was the most anticipated movie of 2020. A year ago, this would have been the movie that most of us would have said was on our top one or two that we were most looking forward to.
Hi, this is Jim Crumley, and my favorite movie of the year was Tenet. Tenet had some really interesting ideas that Christopher Nolan did some cool things with. Also had stunning visuals.
Is Jim right, or is he off his rocker as he usually is when it comes to movies?
I'm not going to say Jim is wrong. I despise Tenet. I thought it was horrible. I saw 75 movies this year, and it is my 69th rank. So it's very, very close to the bottom. It made no sense. It even like tells you during the movie, don't worry, this doesn't make any sense. So like, don't really pay attention to it. Just like feel the movie, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. Found it could be completely incoherent, high on its own supply.
It's the temple movie that failed. I don't mind the fact that a lot less people saw it than otherwise would have.
If it does get re-released like in IMAX or whatever, which I assume it probably will, it is a movie that I would be inclined to try again in a theater, just like have the opportunity to actually just like turn my head off and feel it as the movie instructs us to, I wouldn't mind having that experience at some point in the future. I wouldn't go in expecting to like it, just more to like experience it.
Fair enough. Quick technical note, the seating in the bracket that we're about to start is based upon average critic rankings. So this is not the seating of how much Av and I like the movies per se. This is an average of Letterboxd, IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, and all the rest of them.
There are three first round matchups that feature two movies that are in my top 10. It's going to get very messy very early for me, at least.
Last technical note, we're going to do the first two rounds back to back. So we're going to do the round of 32 and then the round of 16, such that when we come back around, having touched all four quadrants, we'll have an elite eight of eight finalist movies to discuss. Are you ready to bracket?
Yeah, you asked me that like 5 minutes ago, and I said yes. So we're going to start out in the top left quadrant of our bracket, where we have the number one overall seed, Hamilton, and it will be going up against the winner of our play-in matchup, and that is going to be between Archive, a sci-fi movie written and directed by Gavin Rothery in his directorial debut, stars Theo James, and that will be up against The Father, which was written and directed by Florian Zeller, based on his 2012 play, and that stars Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman.
The first of a few based on a play.
We do have a larger than usual number of those this year. Father is a movie that I think it's coming out maybe in February. Anthony Hopkins plays a man, and Olivia Colman is his daughter, and is starting to suffer from some sort of dementia or Alzheimer's. I don't know exactly if they say what his exact diagnosis is, and what the movie does in a really cool way is kind of put you in his perspective and puts you in a position where you yourself don't really know what you're seeing is real and which things to kind of like anchor onto as like the true parts of the story versus the made up part of the story, and the kind of vacillates in between those, which was a very unique and very interesting experience to be put in.
This was a number one movie for certain people. Felt it should get its shine for 2020. There are a number of movies that came out effectively after the year ended. The Father is the most egregious of those. As a statement against all of those, I saw every single one except The Father. So I did not see The Father. It's the only movie in this bracket I did not see. I will see it as a 2021 movie, and I will enjoy it even on my lonesome in that context. I was championing Archive for much of the year, and I really loved it. I would say the design of it is incredible. If you're a fan of AI or robotics or sci-fi in general, then it's a must watch. And I'd say most viewers will appreciate it, even if maybe, you know, they're frustrated by the ending, any other element. I think the human character it puts into robots is really beautiful. The music is also great. The director of Archive was also sort of, I think his title was senior design artist on Moon. And so there's sort of parallels. You can see the two movies sort of speak to each other.
It's kind of a combination of Moon and I think there was a movie called I Am Mother from a couple years ago.
There are callbacks to great sci-fi movies, certainly. You know, it's also a lot of sci-fi movies are engaged in this sort of man creating robot, trying to make it into a human conceit of this movie. I'm going to give a strong vote to The Archive, as you could imagine.
I would give it a fairly modest edge to The Father. I think I liked it more. I think it's better made. The acting is sensational by both Anthony Hopkins and Olivia Colman. My vote here would be for The Father. So I guess we would have our first tie. Why don't we just jump to the first round? And I, you know, for me, it's easy to say that Hamilton easily beats either one of these. So it kind of renders the play-in matchup moot in a way.
To hear a bit more about Hamilton, can we go to our listener who made it his number one of the year?
Can understand the debate around even including this as a movie. The best thing I saw all year and one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had watching anything was Hamilton. It's the one movie I watched this year that I can't wait to see in theaters, hopefully, if they release it one day. It's a bit unfair to compare everything else I saw to the years-long culmination of getting to see this entire musical play out, but honestly, it took all of my expectations and shot them straight into the air. I've rewatched it many times, and it was absolutely the number one movie that I saw this year.
You sympathize with Svi as well?
Very close to the top of my list. Hamilton is a play or a musical. I've seen it three times on Broadway. It's, you know, in my opinion, one of the best things ever made. Not best plays, not best musicals, not best movies. It's just like one of the best pieces of pop culture that's ever been put together. Lin-Manuel Miranda is a genius. Adaptation into a movie, the Disney Plus version, is one of the best musical adaptations I've ever seen. It's not, I guess it's not really an adaptation, it's just a filming of the screen, but it's done in such a, you know, cinematic way that even gives you a better perspective on a lot of things than you would ever get at the show unless you're like literally in the first or second row.
You know, we spoke about Hamilton at some length earlier this year, and also I know you discussed it on another movie podcast to relitigate that. But that one point I think we never really discussed, which is how many movies of stage plays have you seen that you can sort of make that claim? We don't often sit down and watch, or at least I don't, movies, filmings of plays, do we?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess maybe there haven't been, but you know, I have seen a number what's on YouTube or here and there, and this was just so much more professionally done and done in a way that really brings the musical to life in your home. And maybe this hasn't been done before to this extent, but credit to them for that if that's the case as well.
I loved Archive. It's a top 10 movie of the year for me. Hamilton, I think, is a top 20, but I'm willing to concede back to you and let Hamilton follow. The writing, the conceit in terms of the whole concept of how it's set up, some of the performances are really wonderful. And ultimately for me, it's just not enough of a movie. I hear what you're saying, and I respect the fact that they made a play and they filmed it well, but it doesn't add enough cinematic oomph to sort of become a special movie. It's a really great filming of a fantastic play. The idea of like going on a road trip and listening to Hamilton, the music, to my mind, that's kind of more appealing and singing along than sitting down and, you know, getting popcorn and watching the filming of a play.
Fair enough. Well, you should do that. I've listened to the Hamilton soundtrack hundreds of times without exaggeration.
So you would vote for the Hamilton soundtrack over the Hamilton movie?
If given the choice, you know, you're going to be just sitting around for the next 3 hours, and which one are you going to do? I would choose to watch it because there is a visual element to the show that is just magnificent.
You can't get King George's spittle from the soundtrack.
So our next matchup is the number 16 seed Promising Young Woman, written, directed by Emerald Fennell and starring Carey Mulligan as a woman whose best friend was raped in medical school, and she's looking for some sort of revenge / catharsis. And that is going to go up against the 17th seeded The Trial of the Chicago 7, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin, starring, among others, Mark Rylance, Frank Langella, Sacha Baron Cohen, Eddie Redmayne, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And it tells the true life story of the Trial of the Chicago 7, specifically seven people who were tried for their involvement at the 1968 Chicago riots during the Democratic National Convention.
I think Promising Young Woman, it's a contender for me to go all the way. Everything in Promising Young Woman is for a purpose. It's not just sort of a rom-com / revenge thriller for no purpose. I mean, all of those are delivering it to a certain conclusion. And I think that conclusion is very powerful. And therefore, to me, Promising Young Woman is going to be the easy win over a movie that had sort of a flick of the week feel to it. Best part of Chicago 7 is Sorkin's script and Sacha Baron Cohen's acting. Promising Young Woman for me is an easy win between the 16 versus 17. This is on paper, you know, maybe the most competitive matchup we face.
These movies are both in my top 10 for the year. Somewhat of a tough call for me, although not really. Trial of the Chicago 7 was a movie that I really, really enjoyed. I am as big of an Aaron Sorkin fan as there is. I love pretty much everything that he does. He's my favorite screenwriter of all time. This movie is very Sorkin-y, both in terms of the ideas that he explores, in terms of practicality versus idealism in left-wing politics, and the idea of radicals who don't know how to just declare victory and spike the football when they won instead of continuing the fight. I think it's a really powerful idea that is very resonant for a lot of social issues of today. It also has some of those like Sorkin-y flourishes that rub a lot of people the wrong way. The way it can be like overly melodramatic and just too in love with his own words. Promising Young Woman, I've seen it twice now. The first time I saw it, I liked it. And I kind of just like didn't know what to do with it, especially the third act left me a little bewildered. It just kind of like gnawed at me for a while. The more it stuck with me and the more I thought about it, the more my appreciation for it started to grow. Prompted me to see it a second time, and I saw it with my wife, which I thought was potentially risky, but it worked out well. She really liked it as well. I would say that Promising Young Woman is by far the movie this year that I've listened to like the most podcasts. Basically every time it drops into my feed from one of the probably at this point 100 different movie podcasts that I subscribe to.
All of which you are probably a host or a co-host, no?
Last year, it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Parasite and Avengers Endgame that anyone who was wanted to talk about the movie, I was like up for listening to what they had to say. That process of it sitting with me and then seeing it again has caused it to just like vault up my rankings for the year and is now a movie that I just absolutely love. I can't stop thinking about it. I'm still like not exactly sure what the message of the ending of the movie is supposed to be vis-a-vis and how justice is meted out to the people who either perpetrated or complicit in bad acts in the past and like what we're supposed to do with that. And I'm not sure the movie necessarily has an answer to that, which is fine. On paper, you know, these are both movies in my top 10, but to me, there's still a stark divide and I easily vote for Promising Young Woman to advance.
Perhaps an even more challenging matchup for you, because if we jump to the next round.
It's Hamilton now against Promising Young Woman. Now these are both movies that are in my top five for the year. But I think some of what you pointed out about Hamilton and, you know, whether it's really a movie or just, you know, filming of it, maybe against what predictors had said, I am going to cast my vote once again for Promising Young Woman.
It won't be a tie there. I don't think it's a surprise.
Okay, so on to our next matchup, and that is going to be the number 9C, Time, is a documentary directed by Garrett Bradley that follows a woman fighting for the release of her husband who's been in prison for 60 years. And that will be going up against The Invisible Man, the 24th seeded, written and directed by Leigh Whannell, and starring Elizabeth Moss, a woman who is being both physically and emotionally abused by her husband, and she's trying to escape.
One of our listeners, Cedric, sent in his pick for number one movie of the year.
Hello, There Will Be Pod. This is Cedric, aka The Said Said on Twitter, and my favorite film of 2020 is The Invisible Man, for two reasons. It's the last movie I saw in theaters, but most importantly, it's a film that fostered a strong sense of paranoia in me solely through its cinematography. The film keeps the viewer confused in a good way. Is she alone, or is there someone there in the room with her? You don't know, and it really kept me on the edge of my seat the whole time. Oh, and of course, Elizabeth Moss. You can't go wrong with her. Thank you so much, There Will Be Pod. Happy New Year. Happy 2021.
I caught up with Invisible Man at the very end of the year. I also caught up with Time in 2021. I would not recommend Time, bottom line. The movie went for the poetry of a woman has this lost time from her husband when he's locked up. And by going for the poetry of that, it left ignored the deeply complex and challenging issues that the movie is otherwise about, incarceration, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to deal more with those complex, thorny issues, and I didn't feel that it really engaged them because it was trying to be more of a poetic exercise, but it didn't really engage me. And I think there was like a better, more challenging movie that could have been made with the material there. And therefore, Invisible Man, which isn't my kind of movie really, but I respect the fact that it's tight. It has an allegory that it holds on to the whole time. Invisible Man in the title, I like how he's presented. The actor who plays him is a non-character in the movie. You know, if you or I could have played him and probably done as, you know, good a job because he's barely on screen. I'm going with Invisible Man.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Invisible Man as well. It's one of, I think, only three movies that I saw in a theater this year. And it was the only good movie I saw in a theater this year. The other two were Doolittle, which is my lowest ranked movie of the year. And Croods 2. My in-laws were nice enough to rent out a movie theater just for our family and, you know, my wife's siblings and their families. And the kids all liked it. So we'll leave it at that.
Way to throw your in-laws under the bus.
I said they were very nice.
Thanking them for showing you a movie that you did not predict.
Well, I didn't like it, but I would think I was the only one who didn't like it out of the like 15 people there. So won't hold that against them. All of the kids loved it. So that was the goal. Invisible Man, I really, really enjoyed. It does a great job of just like taking that concept of abuse and gaslighting and just like putting that into like physical manifestation. Has what I would say was probably one of the most amazing scenes of the year. The scene in the restaurant towards the middle just absolutely blew me away. I think a lot of people have ranked that as their favorite scene of 2020 and across all movies. So yeah, this is an easy one for me. Time didn't stand out to me as being much different from many other documentaries about somebody dealing with, you know, a loved one who's in jail. One thing that I did appreciate about Time is it's not about his guilt or innocence and whether or not he was like railroaded in his original trial. It's more about the reality of what that does to a family and the way that lives are destroyed. And even though, you know, this isn't necessarily a person that we want to admire who did this, but, you know, he still has a family and a life that gets left behind, and we see the toll that it takes on them.
I just felt Time was very disjointed and unengaging. If it would have been 40 minutes shorter and 40 minutes in the middle weren't there, I wouldn't have noticed and I would have liked it more. Who's Invisible Man going to face in the second round?
The winner of our next matchup, which is Sound of Metal and Mogul Mowgli. Sound of Metal is a movie starring Riz Ahmed in which he plays a musician that suffers a debilitating illness or impairment and as a result has to contemplate his own mortality and the ways in which his artistic expression have become part of his identity. Mogul Mowgli, which is a movie that stars Riz Ahmed playing a musician who suffers a medical impairment and has to deal with the ways in which by confronting his own mortality, he has to wonder how his artistic expression will become part of his identity.
This came up randomly ranked by critics as the 8 and the 25 matchup, but it couldn't be more perfect. These two movies had to face each other.
Yeah, these are the same movie, except that I think one is very good and one is not that good.
I was championing Mogul Mowgli. I think it's challenging, no question, but I just think it takes you deep into sort of an immigrant tale. I would say it's like an immigrant experience more than almost anything else. Sound of Metal, I think, is really special for, brings you into sort of a debate inside the deaf community of identity. And then the way how it uses sound, I'm going to vote for Mogul Mowgli. Both of them are in my top 15. Sound of Metal, the movie just feels overly dragged out. Him and his girlfriend are together at the beginning, and then it seems like years pass, and then she's all of a sudden like the main character again with him at the very end. And it didn't really hold me enough over the course of it. But Mogul Mowgli, Riz Ahmed, is on another level. And it makes sense because Riz Ahmed is the power behind Mogul Mowgli. It's basically his story. It's like a fictional version of his story. He made Mogul Mowgli with a close friend to sort of reflect his own kind of deep personal issues that he's wrestled with for years. And therefore, it reflects itself on screen. I mean, Mogul Mowgli is a much more personal movie, a much more intimate movie, a much more challenging movie, I think. On the one hand, it's a very high specificity, meaning taking us deep into a culture we otherwise know nothing about unless we've seen a bad Bruce Springsteen movie from last year. And on the other hand, is universal. You know, I think father and son and immigrant and other elements are things that all of us can relate to. So I'm going to vote for the second of the two exchangeable Riz Ahmed movies, and I'll leave it to you.
I think we're going
to
have our first tiebreaker because this is an easy choice for me on Sound of Metal. I guess it was kind of the point, but I just found Riz Ahmed's character in Mogul Mowgli to be so detestable and like just like such an asshole. And, you know, it does, you know, it is addressed. He is, you know, taken to task for his behavior that it kind of just like disengaged me from the movie. Like I like didn't really care about him because I didn't like him. Whereas in Sound of Metal, you know, he's obviously a person who has had his demons and had his past issues. You know, we learned that he had issues with drug abuse in the past and he was in and out of rehab. That deafness angle that I think really took it to the next level, and just like seeing the other people dealing with it, and as specifically the Paul Racy character, who was one of the best performances of the year. I think he's
great.
One thing that I think both movies do very well is shows you the way in which, you know, the masculinity that goes along with having this type of career, whether it's a heavy metal drummer or a rapper, doesn't allow Riz Ahmed's character in either movie to outwardly reckon with like what he's going through. And like you see he's very frequently putting on a very brave face, but like we as the viewer can see just like the looks of panic. Like this is a guy in both movies that is like scared for his life, that like his life as you know it is slipping away from him. There's no way for him to reconcile that sort of vulnerability with the identity that he's crafted for himself based on his career. So he's fantastic in both movies. Just because I really liked his character in one and really hated his character in the other, that made a huge difference. My vote is for Sound of Metal.
I think exactly what you dislike about it is a point in the favor of Mogul Mowgli, which is, you know, there's one scene that really got to me from Mowgli when he's effectively doing something that I've been through IVF infertility treatment with my wife over the last year and a half, doing a process that people in IVF to participate in. And there's this like hilarious but asshole of a scene. And maybe you remember what I'm talking about, Alf, where he calls up an ex-girlfriend, basically, yes, while he's basically freezing his sperm. And you just want to be like, dude, like, you're such a selfish asshole. Like, get out of yourself. Like, who are you? And yet, I just
think narcissism in Mogul Mowgli is off the charts. But that's, I guess, what you would expect from a, you know, MC rapper.
It just feels more personal and more real. And Sound of Metal is a little bit to me more of like an actor responding to a director's cues. You're very reflective. You're a bit detached. You're sort of in shock. And Mogul Mowgli just seems Ahmed in the moment. And that rap scene, that was someone filmed Riz Ahmed performing somewhere and then showed it to the director, and the director was like, wow, that's an incredibly powerful scene. I want that as kind of, and that's the trailer. If you watch the trailer for Mogul Mowgli, the scene of him rapping, it was sort of folded into the movie. Captures to me the power and the intimacy of Mogul Mowgli. I think it's the best male role of the year by Ahmed. With that said, I'll concede to you and Sound of Metal can pass. And the reason I'm conceding is, you know, I like both, you like one, and very strongly, and therefore I just think the balance is a bit more towards Sound of Metal.
Sound of Metal having advanced and will now go up against Invisible Man. So what do you say there?
I'm going to go Sound of Metal strongly. Invisible Man, two issues it had in its way. One is, I don't know, Elizabeth Moss doesn't do it for me as an actress. I like her in TV shows. Whenever she's in a movie, it just rubs me the wrong way. I find her sort of fake somehow on screen. It never works for me. So, and then the second thing is, in this comic movie, the all-powerful force to be invisible is being used by a guy to play tricks on his ex-wife. And there's something about that which is both remarkable and I admired, but at the same time, at some point I was just like, he invented this incredible, like transformative technology in order to sort of live in an attic and mess around with his ex-wife. Something about that just never really fit for me. And the whole time I was a little bit thrown off. Sound of Metal, it's my easy vote.
Pass Sound of Metal on to the next round. I had these pretty close to each other in my ranking. So given your strong favoring of Sound of Metal, that makes it an easy tiebreak.
So let's jump off, if we can, to the next side of the bracket, where our number two movie is Nomadland. And with that said, one of our viewers said this, the number two movie for critics, was his number one of the year. So let's listen to what Aaron Brooks had to say.
For my number one movie of 2020, a very good year in movies despite all the obstacles and all the cancellations, is Nomadland. Chloe Zhao's direction style continues to show here from her previous work, both in The Rider, as well as Songs My Brother Taught Me, both really worth watching, using real life people from the environments they are observing. Frances McDormand was my favorite performance of the year. I was absolutely transfixed by her performance. This might be my favorite performance of hers, and she has a lot of great ones. Not just a performance by Frances, but the performance by the individuals she's surrounded by are beyond human and beyond beautiful. So props to Chloe Zhao, beautiful piece of work, and thank you for making my number one movie of 2020.
Aaron, who might have emerged as our favorite Brooks brother of 2020 in terms of There Will Be Pod. I think Zach was the dominant Brooks brother of 2019 on our podcast. And then his brother, who we only knew as a name, eventually displaced him.
Yeah, I actually didn't even believe that he really existed until he came onto our podcast.
Yeah, me too. Zach would always be like, my brother who loves movies says, he was always referencing his brother. And I was like, this guy's so fake. Like Zach just wants to like buttress his own opinion. But yeah, but Aaron came on strong. And he was a wonderful guest. Nomadland, directed by Chloe Zhao, who previously directed 2018 Sensational The Rider. It stars the always impressive Frances McDormand. A woman in her elder age loses everything in the Great Recession and then embarks on a journey as a nomad living out of her van in the American West. And it's going up against the number 31, On the Rocks, a movie we covered earlier this year, directed by Sofia Coppola. It stars Bill Murray, who's often in her movies, and Rashida Jones. Again, female director. Nomadland, On the Rocks.
On the Rocks, I thought it was just like very breezy and enjoyable. Bill Murray is amazing in it. Nomadland is a movie that I'm not quite as high on as the critics, although I still really did appreciate it. It has just like these like stunning visuals of the American landscape. And Frances McDormand is incredible as always. There's not like a ton of story here, which might make it difficult for some people to engage with it. It's definitely one of those where you kind of just want to let it wash over you because it's really more of a character study. And as I said, just kind of like taking it all in. So that said, I will give my vote Nomadland, but it's not a strong preference.
I'll add to that, as Aaron said, Chloe Zhao has such a distinct touch as a director. I mean, I love The Rider. I actually found The Rider much more emotionally compelling. I found Nomadland more powerful for its contemporary social message. And maybe the best thing I'll say about Nomadland, leave it as this, is that for the first half of Nomadland, all I could think about was the Chris Farley skit from Saturday Night Live. By the second half of the movie, I'd completely forgotten about how he lives in a van down by the river. To my mind, Nomadland, in a word, is about moving on from memory and sort of knowing how to say goodbye. Nomadland is the easy winner. Let's go to our next matchup, which is going to be number 15, Palm Springs, versus number 18, Shithouse. Palm Springs, directed by Max Barbacow, stars Andy Samberg, talk about Saturday Night Live, and Kristen Bellotti. It's a rom-com about a couple that meet at a wedding and get stuck in a Groundhog Day-style time loop. And number 18, Shithouse, directed, written, and starring Cooper Raff, who is now 24 years old, which makes me think that everyone listening to this can feel equally inadequate. Shithouse is about a homesick college freshman played by the director who's trying to figure out how to fit in while, you know, falling in love. Palm Springs, Shithouse. One of these movies was someone's favorite of the year, so let's take a listen to our friends from Cinema Chop Shop.
I'm Travis.
I'm Sean.
I'm Chelsea.
From the Cinema Chop Shop podcast, a movie podcast that concedes that remakes are going to happen, so why shouldn't movie buffs
like us
decide who's recast in those iconic roles? My favorite movie of the year was Palm Springs, directed by Max Barbacow. And it's his feature film debut. No spoilers. This stars Andy Samberg as Niles, a wedding plus one who is completely over any sense of decorum. Kristen Bellotti as Sarah, the sister of the bride and a reluctant maid of honor who has plenty of issues of her own. and J.K. Simmons as Roy, another guest at the wedding, older, kind of take no guff, brass tacks type. This movie is hilarious, charming, but also intriguing. Once again, we are Cinema Chop Shop.
What do you think? Palm Springs, Shithouse.
Both near the very top of my rankings for the year. I have probably been the world's biggest ambassador of Shithouse, telling everyone that I know that they should see it and that I loved it. It just really, really resonated for me. Basically takes the standard college frat house, puts like an introvert into it, someone who's just really shy and homesick, and just college is just like not working out for him the way that he expected and the way that I guess like everyone always dreams, oh, you know, you go to college, you're going to have the time of your life. And he's just like not having that experience. At different points in my life, I've just felt like very fish out of water and struggled socially to adjust to new surroundings. It's almost eighth grade for college, I think.
Yeah.
I thought it was just like really powerful. Going up against Palm Springs, though, is a tough draw for Shithouse. Palm Springs is, in many ways, the movie of 2020. Not to belabor your warning from earlier in the podcast. It's just an absolutely perfect quarantine movie. The perfect movie at the perfect time for at least what I needed, and I think what many people needed in those early days of quarantine. Just something light, but at the same time, very emotionally deep and powerful. Two absolutely lovable characters, played by Christian Milioti and Andy Samberg, that you're just like rooting for them from the second you meet them. Some outrageously funny montage scenes, very heady, cool time travel concepts, and just an absolute blast. My vote is for Palm Springs, even though it would be sad for me to see Shithouse go out early.
Poor Shithouse, so alone, will not make out of the first round. I'm going to go for Palm Springs as well, though. Also, Palm Springs, if you remember when we discussed it on the pod, it follows tropes too much for me to love it. It is a rom-com, like full on. You know, everything you expect to happen in a rom-com, when the couple's supposed to break up, when they're supposed to get back together.
That's true.
I didn't find it very funny. It's super engaging. Andy Samberg and Milioti both have tons of charisma. I will say my favorite Andy Samberg vehicle might still be 7 Days in Hell. I laughed a lot more in 7 Days in Hell, the tennis movie, than I did in Palm Springs. Palm Springs is going up against Nomadland.
Palm Springs was just, for me, the perfect movie at the perfect time. It's one of the few movies this year that I would tell everyone in the world should see Palm Springs. I can't imagine somebody seeing Palm Springs and not liking it. So gets my vote.
To me, Nomadland, much better than Into the Wild, the young kind of teenage boy who runs off to the wild and bums around in the American West.
In Nomadland, Chloe Zhao manages to really weave a deeply personal journey about a woman that cannot let go of the past, and hence she feels alienated from the present against the backdrop of this fascinating subculture of elderly Americans displaced by the economic, the social disruption to the fabric of American society. And it's the melding of those two. It's Chloe Zhao effectively making this broader generational story of America into a single heroine's deeply personal path to move on from the past. The movie's source material, the book Nomadland, provides the story of elderly nomads. But the personal conflict that really gives this movie a rare soul, that is a creation of the director and the lead actress. And the best of those moments comes through when we see McDormand, who otherwise is so alienated amongst crowds of people in big factories, even at these gathering of nomads, and yet at certain few moments in the film, by the sea, in the mountains, in the woods, in those few moments, see her emerging from her shell.
That element of Nomadland, more so than anything else, more so than the acting, more so than, you know, the camera and the music and anything else, is what I really appreciated. Palm Springs, it's too much trope. It's not special enough for me. And therefore, I'm going to go for Nomadland. You went for Palm Springs. Av, your tiebreaker on this one. Which one do you want to move on? The Elite Eight.
We can move Nomadland forward just because, in addition to the reasons you said, it is a movie that is getting more fanfare now. So I want to see it remain in the mix.
Number 10, Boys State, directed by Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. It's a documentary about an annual event in Texas where thousands of high school boys gather together and pretend to be politicians. And it's going up against number 23, Mank, directed by David Fincher, stars Gary Oldman. Mank is, of course, reevaluating 1930s Hollywood through the eyes of screenwriter Herman J. Mankiewicz as he races to finish the screenplay of Citizen Kane. Number 10, Boys State. Number 23, Mank. Both of them were a feature on our podcast this past year. So either one of them to me is really great. I'm going to go with Mank.
I was high on both of these movies. Boys State is really well done. And I think it's something that is useful to anyone. Mank is probably less accessible to mainstream audiences. I could certainly see a lot of people turning a Mank off after 30 minutes and saying, I have no idea what I'm watching. I'm not, you know, I don't care about this. It's in black and white. I don't know who anybody is. It does a lot of things really, really well. It's definitely a movie that has a filmmaker with a very distinct vision, and he does an excellent job at carrying out that vision, and certainly has a lot to say about the artistic process and how we should allocate credit to different collaborators, all of which I found really interesting, especially set against the backdrop of old Hollywood and re-examining one of the most important movies ever made. So I will vote for Mank as well.
Mank is moving on. Number 7, Never Rarely Sometimes Always, directed by Aliza Hittman, stars Sydney Flanagan. It's about a pair of teenage girls traveling to New York City to seek an abortion. And it's going up against number 26, The Assistant, directed and written by another female director, Kitty Green. And it stars Julia Garner. It's a day in the life of a young female assistant to a powerful and predatory movie executive. These two could be the finalists in this entire bracket. And yet here we have them in the first round as a number 7 against a number 26. My vote is going to be for The Assistant. I think it's almost a perfect movie for what it is. Everything in the movie drives toward the theme of where the movie's going. Both movies have a key scene where the lead meets sort of someone who's supposed to be, you know, her source of sustenance. I loved Assistant. It was my number one movie for much of the year. Never Rarely, I just think, is a little too naturalist, a little too dry at times. And I respect it. I didn't love it. Assistant for me.
I'm going to disagree. Although I love The Assistant, it is comfortably in my top 10. Never Rarely Sometimes Always is my number one movie of the year. It is a movie that I just thought was so touching and so personal and just so revelatory. The ways in which our society is built up against certain people to make them achieving their self-actualization difficult and putting up roadblocks in their way. There was another movie, Unpregnant, which tries to do the same thing and spectacularly failed at it, which only made me appreciate Never Rarely even more. The Assistant, I thought, was also sensational. Really, really well done. Day in the life structure that kind of just puts a limelight on just like the seemingly ordinary, horrible things that somebody in that position just like has to endure and just deal with and not bring up and not address and not push back on, because otherwise it will wreck their career. You know, in a lot of ways, they're very similar movies in that regard. It's about structural, foundational parts of society that have just been tilted in certain directions, robbing people of their own agency, robbing them of their autonomy to find their place in the world. For me, the vote is Never Rarely Sometimes Always, though, you know, The Assistant is, I think, a fantastic movie as well.
We're going to go to Matt Stewart, one of our listeners who sent in a brief audio, and he will be our tiebreaker. Matt, take it away.
On the matchup of Never Rarely Sometimes Always and The Assistant, both were beautiful movies looking at a woman's perspective on issues in today's world with abortion and the Me Too movement. But my vote would go to The Assistant. I think it did a masterful job of adding in almost a horror movie element, that with the suspense built in around the boss and the issues around that and everybody being on edge at work, it really hit home not only for the issue and everything that those people have to go through, but every single person can relate to that. I think The Assistant did a brilliant job towing that line while still making a very suspenseful, enjoyable movie.
So Matt, coming down for The Assistant, which means we're going to have The Assistant and Mank. To me, this is easy. Assistant is going on to the lead eight. Goodbye, Mank.
Yep, I agree. All right, with that, that takes us now back down to our next quadrant. So if you're following along on your bracket, you could move to the lower bottom left. First matchup is going to be the number 4 seeded Lover's Rock going up against The Platform. Lover's Rock is part 2 of the 5-part Small Axe anthology. It is the lone representative of Small Axe that made it into this bracket.
Depending upon the round, depending on the motivation, Lover's Rock may be representing all of Steve McQueen's 5, you know, anthology film series, or it may not be. I'm going to let it stand on its own merits when possible. You know, we may give it that extra boost.
The Platform is a Spanish sci-fi movie with some social commentary. It is directed by Galder Gaztula Urrutia. It takes place in a very strange prison. There are different levels, and each set of prisoners on each level is given a different amount of food based on where they are on the platform. We learn fairly quickly into the movie there's this platform that starts all the way at the top and goes all the way back down to the bottom, and everyone basically has like a minute to eat as much as they can, and as you get closer to the bottom, there's going to be less and less food unless the people above you are nice enough to leave some for you. So obviously the social metaphor is pretty self self-explanatory. It's a movie that I thought did a really good job of demonstrating that and just kind of kept me on edge for most of it. Lovers Rock. I'll say just a little bit about Small Axe in general. It's the rare occasion where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. There was none of these five that like I was blown away by the way that some people were. I thought they were all very good. I actually think of it better if you think of it as like a TV show or miniseries, because it ended up being a TV show with like five really good episodes that tie together thematically and kind of like give you a fuller picture of this whole world and the different problems and the way they all intersect. None of the individual ones that I think was incredible.
I'm voting for Lovers Rock. First off, you know, I'll put that out there. It's exhilarating. While not a traditional narrative by no means, it gave me a complete enough movie experience. Over a night at a house party, a reggae house party in the 70s, the music at the time was called Lovers Rock. So, you know, that's where the title comes from. And it gave me a complete immersive experience in people heading out to the party itself, the challenges, some of the social tensions within the party and surrounding the party. Someone, if they wanted, could only watch Lovers Rock and it would be a good time at the movies.
I don't think that Lovers Rock like stood out to me as far superior to any of the other ones. I think it probably is the best one of the five. I liked all five. The anthology is doing a little bit of the work because I am thinking about these people in the context of the other things going on in their lives. The other four parts are really all about different forms of discrimination and hardship this Haitian community faces in London due to racial discrimination. And Lovers Rock is the lone nice, happy story, although there's certainly upsetting parts to it as well.
I don't think it's unusual to sort of let the other movies in this series influence. I mean, last year at this time, we were discussing Endgame, and there's no question that part of your appreciation for Endgame is the broader MCU series. And so, you know, I think it's always fair. In terms of the platform, I don't know which way you're going to vote here. I think it is, on some level, a horror movie, though it's more a sci-fi social message than
a... It's a sci-fi movie with a good amount of body horror in it.
Yeah, exactly. I do think its limitation is that it ultimately is way too heavy-handed. Nuances, you know, thrown aside, like the movie throws many things aside, and not enough of the characters are really more than symbols. Probably the notable exception, I forget what his name is, but I called him the Mr. Magoo, the original roommate of the protagonist. Mr. Magoo, if you know the reference, was the character I remembered after the movie far more than anyone else. Every other character is a symbol. I mean, the movie is basically symbols interacting to sort of communicate different political messages. My vote, Lovers Rock.
I'll vote for Lovers Rock. Well, it's a closer matchup for me than it is for you. I'll give the edge to Lovers Rock, especially in the broader context of the whole Small Axe switch. So that takes us to our next matchup, and that is First Cow, the number 13 seed, written and directed by Kelly Reichardt, against the 20th seed, The Five Bloods, written and directed by Spike Lee, and featuring a star-studded cast, headlines by Chadwick Boseman, recently deceased, and
Delroy Lindo is sort of
I guess he is the main character, yeah. Kelly Reichardt Cards movies are movies that I've been pretty hit or miss with me. Wendy and Lucy, I thought was really good, but then there's like other ones of hers didn't really connect with. Meek's Cutoff, not a bad example of that. First Cow, I think, falls into that latter category. Even like 45 minutes into this, I was, all right, when is this movie going to start? And it was really hard for me to connect with. It's a real, real slow burn that I just never really caught up with. Five Bloods, we spoke about earlier this year on the podcast, and I thought it was really, really well done. The way that it explores PTSD by using the adult actors, even the flashbacks, and just showing the ways that systemic racism and the way that pop culture influences things both at home and afar, people on a journey to kind of reconnect with their past selves and make up for past wrongs, which I thought was a really powerful story with lots of resonance for stories of today. So pretty easy vote for me for The Five Bloods here.
You know, within the first 5 minutes that this is a Spike Lee movie, it is overpacked to the gills, way too much going on. I watched it with my wife halfway through, when they're digging around looking for the missing gold. And she said, oh, this is sort of like a TV movie, right? Point is that there are sort of gaps that aren't really tied together and that we sort of just take them for granted because Spike is trying to tell a Spike Lee story and he's not trying to tell necessarily an adventure story or a jungle story or a war story. For what it is, it makes a strong impression and it's really enjoyable. And First Cow, there's a through line of artistic tenderness, but the plot is vapid, the characters are flat. Some people say the characters are gentle. To me, they just never rise off the page. The dialogue just sort of hangs there. And the opener removes any tension that this movie may have obtained from the fact that there's sort of a drama or a crime, supposedly giving the forward momentum some oomph. So I'm going to double down with you. I'm going all in on The Five Bloods.
It'll immediately phase off against Lovers Rock. I know where you're going. And I think here's where we're going to disagree. So while I really liked Lovers Rock, The Five Bloods was even better.
I think both of us have a lot of respect for both of them, and there isn't really like a clear lemon here. And therefore, we polled the core There Will Be Pod fan group, and the votes came pouring in for both movies. And I don't know if you're seeing this live as I am.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
That we can call it, right? I believe with all votes collected.
I see Zach Brooks voted for The Five Bloods, and I'm going to say stop the count.
The Brooks brothers immediately tied, so I think they negated each other. So with hundreds of listeners chiming in, the slight advantage went to Lovers Rock.
Okay, so we're going to head down to the next matchup. It is the number 12 seeded Another Round, which is a Danish comedy directed by Thomas Vinterberg, starring Mads Mikkelsen. And it will be facing off against The Vast of Night, a very small, low-budget sci-fi movie directed by Andrew Patterson and starring Sierra McCormick and Jake Horowitz.
Yeah. Can I ask you about Mikkelsen? What do you associate Mikkelsen with? Like, what movie immediately is like, that's the Mikkelsen movie I know?
I know he was in Rogue One, and he was in Doctor Strange, so he's definitely got his time on the franchise tour. I think he's probably most famous for playing Hannibal Lecter in the TV show.
He has a face and a mannerism that this movie, I think, really takes advantage of. Another Round is a hangout movie of, which I know you sort of have a soft spot for, but it's a hangout movie in Danish, which you maybe lessens the soft spot. Conceit of Another Round, which is middle-aged guys are sort of using drinking to get over their sort of midlife crisis. That to me was the weakest part of the movie. And that's kind of a problem in that that's most of the movie. And the movie therefore kind of dragged me a bit, but the ending is really fun. I won't spoil it. To me, Mikkelsen is a guy I'll spend 2 hours with in a hangout movie. And therefore my vote is going to be for The Vast of Night.
My vote is going to be for The Vast of Night as well. I hated Another Round. I didn't enjoy a single second of it. The whole premise of it is so ridiculous, where like these four guys decide that like the key to solving their malaise in life is that they're all going to start drinking at work, where they work as public school teachers.
They never consider why that may lead them into serious problems.
Yeah, why might this go badly? But of course it goes badly, because their whole plan is to get drunk at work where they teach at school.
People in Europe drink a ton more than people in the US, by and large. It speaks a bit more to sort of the culture which it's set in than maybe, you know, somewhat what we relate to.
The Vast of Night is a lot like an episode of The Twilight Zone. Very small and contained. It's vast in a way in terms of like the world opening to the possibility of alien and foreign life. But the smallness of the movie contrasted with that idea, I think does it a lot of good. And it's something that I would definitely check out. There's a lot of tension in it, great character work.
To me, the best part of A Vast of Night is the audio. I think we tried to capture that in the intro to this episode. The weakest part of The Vast of Night is actually the strongest part of Another Round, which is I was let down by the ending of The Vast of Night. I was enjoying spending time with the characters. The ending it sort of just rushed into was what I sort of, I guess, expected from a Twilight Zone sci-fi. I would have preferred a different ending. And there's endings we discussed earlier this year on the pod that could have, I think, improved Vast of Night. And therefore, Another Round will not be moving on to Another Round. You know, its original title was Not Another Round. So I think they changed the title for our bracket.
For American?
No, for the Will Be Pod bracket. They were planning to go round by round, thanks to their title.
It's very disappointing for them. That was probably a very costly decision that paid off not at all. Last matchup in this quadrant, that is going to be the documentary Dick Johnson is Dead, made by famous documentarian Kristen Johnson about her relationship with her father. Go up against Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things, star Jesse Plemons and Sammy's favorite woman of 2019, Jesse Buckley.
Exactly. These movies came out within weeks of each other. Their names, I would say they speak to each other. You know, I'm Thinking of Ending Things and Dick Johnson is Dead. They're both movies about an elderly white guy, frankly, who is reflecting on his life or, you know, looking back at the past and looking toward, his likely near-term death. Avi, you had more concerns with Dick Johnson is Dead, the documentary, than I did. The weakest part of it was what you identified, which is I also didn't need as much of the gamemanship, pretending to have her father be killed on camera as a way to come to terms with his, you know, potential near-term death. But the sentiment, the father-daughter relationship, the relationship between him and his wife, the relationship between him and his friend, it was one of the best, I would say, performances of a guy on a French horn or whatever instrument his friend was playing, 2020. And just watching Dick Johnson eat chocolate cake. I don't like chocolate, but watching Dick Johnson enjoy a good slice of chocolate cake, that was one of the 2020 movie moments I will remember. So I'm giving the vote to Dick Johnson is Dead. there was just, even with Jesse Buckley, there was just way too much going on that I didn't connect with in Ending.
We have another disagreement, because I'm going to vote for I'm Thinking of Ending Things. These are both movies where what they had to say was more interesting to me than the actual experience of watching the movie. Like, I enjoyed thinking about these movies and hearing about them and talking about them more than the actual experience of watching either one. That aspect of it more interesting for I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and I enjoyed the movie itself more. Largely probably just because it was a narrative film as opposed to a documentary, and just by its nature, I'm going to find that more engaging most of the time. And it does have two really good leads. For those reasons, I'm going to give the edge to Charlie Kaufman.
Thinking of Ending Things, and I don't know how many times you've saw it, it's a movie that is more enjoyable in future watches, because there's a lot of, there's very heavy dialogue. Even the way it's delivered is sort of hard to appreciate. And, you know, I think the more times you watch it, frankly, I just couldn't watch it more than once because I was just too turned off. Dick Johnson is Dead, it's a movie that really gets you the first time. It really touched me. To me, this is a strong Dick Johnson is Dead vote. Should we go to our audience of thousands of listeners?
We can pull them.
The floor creaks, the door squeaks, and a mouse starts a nibbling on the broom, and the sun flicks my eyes. It was all a pack of lies. I'm awake and alone.
It looks like there's no other vote, so we can say that the winner of the Dick Johnson is Dead versus I'm Thinking of Anything was Dick Johnson, except then Dick Johnson now immediately loses to The Vast of Night. Welcome to the Elite Eight, heading up against Lover's Rock in the next rounds. We'll see you soon.
To the final quadrant in the first and second round of this bracket, starting off with the number one seed in this corner is number three, Minari, which was directed and written by Lee Isaac Chung, stars Steven Yeun. And Minari is about the director's personal childhood story, which is it's a Korean immigrant family starting a farm in 1980s Arkansas. It is going up against Borat 2, a Sacha Baron Cohen joint, Borat's subsequent movie film directed by Jason Wolliner, Maria Bakalova, and Rudy Giuliani, notably, join Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh, who does he play?
Some willingly and some less willingly. Let's hear what our listeners had to say, because I think some notable fans of this podcast felt that one or perhaps both of these movies were their number one. Let's see what Alex Chester had to say.
How often do we see the top lawyer and advisor for the President of the United States taking off his pants and preparing to sexually assault a 15-year-old foreign girl in a hotel room? For that reason alone, Borat is my number one movie of the year.
That was my brother, also known as the co-host of
Pretty Good. I might have done an extra pretty in there, but yeah, that's our Curb Your Enthusiasm podcast. If you're somehow listening to this podcast and don't know that.
An honorary, I think, producer along with Keith Wienerker of There Will Be Pod. Let's see who went all out for Minari.
Hi, my name is Tete, and my favorite movie of 2020 was Minari. I really enjoyed the development of the characters there, and especially David, the little boy, and his grandmother, the evolving relationship between them. It was very endearing and real and human.
Ah, so I have a hard choice here, because some of you may not know, but the voice that just...
Blood versus Water.
Exactly. The voice that just called out for Minari as their number one movie. And she told me after we saw it, this might be her favorite movie of the last 10 years. That, of course, is my amazing wife. Wife, brother, Minari, Borat.
Doctor, pharmacist.
There are stakes on either side here.
Borat was a movie I came into with fairly low expectations, even though I love the original. As I mentioned on our episode where we talked about it, I've kind of like fallen off the Sacha Baron Cohen bandwagon over the last 10 years, seeing a lot of his shtick as manipulative more than revelatory. That being said, it was much funnier and much more insightful than I expected. And I really, really enjoyed it. Minari, I came in with extremely high expectations because it was being widely praised as one of the best movies of the year. And I can certainly see the appreciation for it. Clearly very, very well made, very thoughtful, very beautiful, and just showing the landscapes of the Midwest. It's definitely thematically very powerful and very beautiful to look at times. But it is also, I think, extremely slow-paced. It's not a movie that I would recommend to almost anyone unless you're like a cinephile.
Minari to me was very reductive. I feel like I've seen the same story, the same saga, with maybe not as beautiful light on fields and light on flowers and on rivers, maybe without the Korean immigrants.
I think mapping the immigrant experience onto it a little bit makes a difference, but it's a pretty classic making it an America story. The one thing that I think it does a little differently is the way it kind of switches perspectives between the parents and the kids, and then ultimately lands with more of the kids' perspective. So we're actually telling a different story than we thought we were most of the movie. It's an origin story for a kids and the undoing of a marriage more than the making it in America in the end, but a lot of tropey stuff in it. By the end, it was like, okay, that was nice, but I don't get the fanfare for it that much. My vote is going to be for Borat. I did not expect that to happen, but here we are.
I felt Minari was very similar to Driveways. Driveways was a movie that came out in the beginning of 2020. I don't know, Av, if you caught it. Both of them are about a Korean-American cute kid. Both of them form a relationship with an elderly person. Both of them have a Korean War veteran. The only difference is that Minari has much prettier scenery, and the Korean War veteran in Minari is very, very poorly. He doesn't fit in the movie. Overacting, and his character just doesn't work at all for me in Minari. I also feel the lead doesn't work in Minari. Steven Yeun, I don't think he's particularly great. I think the best part is the grandma and the kid, mainly the grandma. The grandma's a memorable character. Third act of Minari, I liked how sort of it put the pressure on the couple, but it just feels so rushed. It feels like sort of we were having the story, and then all of a sudden it's like, ending, drama, third act has arrived. Borat, which doesn't live up to sort of the Austin Powers funnier sequels standard. But there's no question that the moment for me hearing Sacha Baron Cohen saying, you know, Yakshamach, or like, very nice, you know, watching him run down the street and people are all recognizing him, watching him go into the costume store and, you know, seeing that his own costume is on sale and sort of, you know, looking all uncomfortable. And the way in which it's deeply set in today, Borat 2 is probably the only movie that can fully credibly say that it's speaking to 2020. All of that being said, I'm going to have to vote, of course, with my wife and against my brother. I'm purely voting based upon who sent in the audio. So we do have a tie. My vote's for Minari. Av is for Borat's subsequent movie film. I'm going with the missus. Av is going with his co-host on a podcast, which I guess is almost the same thing as your spouse. And therefore, let's go to the tiebreakers. First, we're hearing from the illustrious Aaron Brooks.
Was not expecting to have to choose between these two. Borat, subsequent movie film, especially the performance by Maria Bakalova. I can't wait to see what she does after this, for her to kind of be able to hang with Sacha Baron Cohen and serve such a useful role. Credit to that. Lee Isaac Chang's Minari is one of my favorite movies of the year. I found it was absolutely beautiful. I said earlier, A24 was at the top of its game this year, and this is another reason why I think this was a beautiful story taking place in the 80s, and not making it a gimmick is an achievement in itself at this point. Steven Yeun, I thought, was wonderful as always, and Alan Kim was a star. I just found this movie to hit me in all the right spots and represent a group of people that I don't think it represented enough. I hope it gets the attention it deserved.
So Aaron's going with Minari, but at the last second, we have one more tiebreaker of roll tape.
This is Tzvi sending in my tiebreaking vote for Minari versus Borat 2. Having sky-high expectations for Borat 2, somehow they were almost met, whereas my expectations for Minari were not really met. The movie was fine. I enjoyed it. I laughed. It was sad, but definitely was not one of my favorite movies of the year, whereas Borat 2 is very nice. I'm so sorry.
Svi spoke to what you said, an expectations game. That's why he voted for Borat. You and I initially split. My wife and my brother split. Our tiebreakers have split. You and I are going to have to settle this the old-fashioned way, which is at the count of three, two, one, paper.
Rock. I thought you're supposed to always play rock. Rock beats everything.
So I was trying to think which of them most represents Minari, and I felt paper does, given what happens in the third act. So Minari does advance, and it will face the winner of the next matchup, which is number 14, Bacurau, against number 19, One Night in Miami. Bacurau was directed by two Brazilian directors, and it has a huge cast. It's a dystopian future. A rural village in Brazil is threatened by outsiders. One Night in Miami is directed by Regina King. It's based on a play by Kemp Powers, whose name will come up with another movie in this corner of the bracket. And what it does, it imagines the night that the icons Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay at the time, Malcolm X, Sam Cooke, and Jim Brown discuss their roles in the civil rights movement and the cultural upheaval of the 1960s. So two very different movies, though there's a lot of upheaval happening in both of them.
So Baccarat is a movie that I appreciated. I enjoyed parts of it. I would say like I really enjoyed like the first 30 minutes and the last 30 minutes, but like the parts in the middle dragged a bit and I was just like a little confused. I guess certainly not as heavy-handed as The Platform in that it doesn't really explain a lot that's going on at all times. It just left me a little bit confused. But it's a movie that I ended up ultimately appreciating and enjoying, although certainly not as much as you did. I know it's one of your favorites of the year. Going up against One Night in Miami, that is a movie that I completely loved. I was totally taken by all four of the main characters in this movie, larger than life, both in real life, and that comes across in this movie, and just watching them pairing up and kind of like going after each other. Portrait of like four different celebrity black men, people who have just for the first time in their life obtained power. They're contemplating the best way to use it and whether they should use it for themselves, whether they should be using it for their community, whether they should be using it to change the country, change the world. Not necessarily more right or wrong than the others. You know, obviously just like depends on your perspective. Absolutely great character work by all four of them. For me, most notably, Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke. I thought he just totally owned every scene that he was in. One of the absolute best performances of the year. And the three others were not far behind him.
Another co-host of a podcast with Av also chimed in, and let's see what they have to say.
This is Zach.
And Brendan.
And we're the hosts of Av's old podcast, The Movie Ladder Podcast. And we wanted to call in. Yeah, we miss you, Av. We wanted to call in and give our, not necessarily our favorite movies, but the movies we ride for the most from 2020, because my favorite will probably be taken by somebody else.
I am going to ride with Regina King's feature film debut, One Night in Miami. I absolutely loved this movie, and I would love to see it go far in the 32 Fans Movie Tournament. Four fantastic powerhouse performances by four fantastic actors, and one debut great directorial performance by Regina King.
You know that 32 Fans Movie Podcast changed their name, right?
What is this? There Will Be Pod? I don't know.
There Will Be Pod is their name now, yes. everybody went through lots of changes in 2020.
I guess they did.
Well, if you like this kind of accuracy over audio, check out our podcast, The Movie Ladder Podcast. Last year, we did 52 movies, basically one per week. They each connected to the one before it. Brendan, what was your favorite movie we covered on The Movie Ladder Podcast?
I think our Hamilton podcast was actually one of the most fun podcasts we did last year. Av was on that one. We all had a really good time. Really tried hard not to burst into song, but you'll have to listen to and find out if we did or not.
And that was a 2020 movie. I think the only 2020 movie we covered on the pod. I am going to say my favorite was a movie that was a huge surprise to me, and it came right towards the end of the year. That was Bad Times at the El Royale. The movie was a lot of fun. It's from 2018, I believe. Congratulations to There Will Be Pod on completing another year of movie reviews.
Congratulations, guys.
Brendan and Av are teaming up, which I'm sure listeners are excited to hear. I'm going to vote for One Night in Miami as well. Baccarat is a movie that I encourage you, if you can, like myself, to watch it with a Brazilian. There's a lot of elements there which reflect Brazil's history, Brazil's contemporary sort of tensions. That said, One Night in Miami was a movie I was, to play the expectation games from before, was a movie I was very excited for. And it probably more than any other 2020 movie exceeded the high expectations I had for it, which, you know, a lot of movies didn't manage to do that. I felt I was in a backstage discussion of a bunch of superheroes.
Yeah.
It's like those few scenes in the various Avenger movies where they're just sort of hanging out in like the lounge room.
All we were missing here was shawarma.
Exactly. I think the weakest part of One Night in Miami is probably the first half an hour. I didn't feel particularly sort of the Jim Brown introduction. To me, the movie really got going fittingly once all four characters were together, cooped up in a room where two of them didn't expect to be spending more than 5 minutes. So One Night in Miami is going to advance. It's going to go directly into Minari. And I think both of us are going to quickly shut the door on Minari.
One Night in Miami is really one of my favorite movies of the year. So not really a close call from my perspective.
For me as well. See who will make it to the lead eight to be facing One Night in Miami. Number 11, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom against number 22, The Kid Detective. Ma Rainey is directed by George Wolfe. It's based on a play by August Wilson, stars Chadwick Boseman and Viola Davis. Tensions are rising during a recording session in the 1920s Chicago between a famous blues singer, Ma Rainey, and her ambitious horn player. So maybe I have to walk back what I said before, Av, about how the most memorable horn performance was in Dick Johnson is Dead. Roasted on my own horn, so to speak. Number 22, Kid Detective, directed and written by Evan Morgan. Adam Brody plays effectively a grown-up Encyclopedia Brown who's still operating as sort of a kiddie detective, but now he's in his 30s. Living in his parents' basement, he's having troubles adulting.
Stuck in the past for reasons that I think the movie does not a good enough job of justifying. I would say that's probably my main complaint about The Kid Detective, other than the third act, which is a complete mess.
I like the failure to adult, like the very last scene in the movie. I like how it ends with that. The point of this movie is not a mystery movie. It's not sort of who did it. We don't really care who did it, though it's sort of fun to follow along. And therefore, Kid Detective to me was very entertaining. But my easy vote is going to be Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Bozeman is great in Defy Bloods in a limited role. He's fantastic in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. The criticism people have for this movie is saying you can feel too much that it's a stage play. I am not so familiar with the works of August Wilson, but the rich theatrical script that Ma Rainey's has is a plus. It's not a minus. And Chadwick brings it to life, and Viola brings it to life. Ensemble cast of musicians bring it to life.
On Kid Detective, I agree with you. The theme of failure to adult is very interesting. Doesn't make sense to me. The idea that like the entire weight of a village is going to fall down on this person because like he failed to solve murder of one of his classmates when he was in high school. No one should be expecting some kid to solve this and fix this problem for an entire community of adults.
If you buy into when you were 10 years old and you were reading Hardy Boys and reading Encyclopedia Brown, in the lens of those books, which the movie builds up, where he is the town hero and he has the key to the town. I think within that context, it works. Clearly, the movie did not succeed in convincing you to accept it.
That was just my biggest problem with it. I never bought into it. And, you know, I thought his performance was really good. And the way it showed those themes and showed him kind of like stuck in the past and like still trying to like recreate that sort of stuff is stuff that really worked for me if it had worked for me in the context of the story, which it didn't. Moraine's, I had a problem with as well. You know, you mentioned the staginess. And what I said right after I saw One Night in Miami is that like I never want to hear as an excuse for a play that was adapted into a movie, well, what are you supposed to do? It's a play. Of course, it's going to feel like a play, because One Night in Miami basically never felt like a play to me. It has a cinematic element to it that completely transcends that and escapes the trappings of the stage performance, whereas Ma Rainey's felt like I was watching a play the entire time. They both take mostly place in one room, so like, you know, that element of it is the same. And despite fantastic performances by Chadwick Boseman and Viola Davis, they both really carry this movie. It was a movie that I found entertaining and I was there with it. I was glad that it was only like 90 or 100 minutes. That's certainly to its benefit. There just wasn't enough there to kind of keep me interested for much longer. That being said, I will still vote for Moraine's together with you because I thought it brought more table than Kid Detective.
Our last first round matchup, number 6, Soul, co-directed by the famous Peter Docter, famous only if you're really into Pixar movies. But
co-directed by Kemp Powers, notably the creator of the play and the source material for the movie One Night in Miami. While neither of us had Soul as our number one of the year, it did take the top spot for at least one of the co-hosts of the Movie Mayhem podcast.
Hey guys, it's your boys.
Me at.
Brian.
From the Movie Mayhem podcast.
And we're here giving our input on the There Will Be Pod 2020 Movie of the Year bracket. Now, we love brackets ourselves. We do one of our own, which will be later down the line, which you could check out.
That's
eventually.
Right.
I have one. So, Matt, what is your pick?
So, I picked Pixar's Soul,
which we did do an episode on, so you can check that out.
Jamie Foxx, Tina Fey.
And I picked Sound of Metal. Mm. It's an Amazon Prime original of Riz Ahmed. Good luck, guys. And happy 2021.
Jamie Foxx plays a New York jazz pianist that finds himself reconsidering life while stuck between the sort of netherworld, between living and dying. Black Bear, which is the number 27 seed, directed by Lawrence Michael Levine, stars Aubrey Plaza, Christopher Abbott. It's a little bit hard to sum up what this movie is about. Effectively, a filmmaker at a creative impasse is trying to get away from her past at a rural retreat. And it sort of plays with, I would say, writer's block element the filmmaker has.
Black Bear is hard to talk about. And Soul, we talked about the month before on the podcast. I know I liked it a lot more than you. It really resonated with me, both like career accomplishment, but also like when it comes to any sort of side project that you're working on, that it's very important to always take stock why you're doing something and who you're doing it for. There's this moment of emptiness that the main character has in Soul, like when he finally like gets to play at like this gig that he's been waiting for. He's like, okay, now what do we do? And like the other person's like, we'll do it again tomorrow. And he's like, oh, okay, I see. I reference this a lot from one of the climactic scenes of Boyhood, the mom saying that line of like, I just like always assumed there would be more. You're kind of chasing this idealized world where if you just like accomplish enough, you'll have this defining moment where you feel like now it's like all real and like you've accomplished what you set out to do. And when in real life, what really just happens is like you take a quick victory lap and then you move on with to the next thing. And I thought that was really powerful recreation of New York, especially in this time when, you know, I haven't been to New York City now in over a year because of the pandemic, and just like seeing,
neither have I.
Just like seeing New York alive and just like beautiful and just like so rich, such a rich tapestry, I thought was wonderful.
Most of the Pixar movies are consistently challenging themes that really make me think, themes that emotionally impact me. Nothing emotionally impacted me in Soul. Nothing made me think. It just felt bland. It felt generic. Kitty elements really sink it at times. The cat is like distractingly bad. Even the animation seems bad. I feel like they threw it in like post. So I agree with you. It's fun to see New York. The New York part is rich. Some of the side characters, the hair cutter from Hamilton is, you know, really fun. The first sort of out and out adult cartoon by Pixar is less ambitious and less challenging than the children-focused movies to date. So far, I'm voting down on Soul, but let's see where you go with Black Bear.
Black Bear is a movie that I don't really even want to say anything about it, because it's really a movie to go in my opinion, knowing as little as possible. The movie's kind of split into two parts. There's a movie that left me completely blown away by it. Like I was just immediately like rushed onto the internet to just like see if I could like read about it, listen to it. I just like wanted to just like unpack this movie as much as possible because I just like found it so powerful, and Aubrey Plaza in it is so incredibly good. She's like been for a while already one of my favorite actors, and I think this is probably her best performance to date. Definitely a movie that I would widely recommend. I think that there's just like a lot to get for people to take out of it. You know, it's also a movie that might leave people cold and confused. I will vote for it over Soul here, even though I like Soul more than you do. I loved Black Bear.
I want to see Soul go up against Ma Rainey's Black Bottom in the next round. I think the two movies are really sort of speaking to each other. Both of them have sort of as this core African-American music experience. There almost is like a Ma Rainey's character in Soul. That said, though, I didn't enjoy Soul, and Black Bear I enjoyed. I would recommend it. I didn't feel there was really that much mystery there. The movie seems to really want to sort of suggest that it's an enigma wrapped up in a puzzle, wrapped up in a whatever. To my mind, it was fairly straightforward. Two stories with sort of a framing device. The second story is much more enjoyable and memorable, and that's where Plaza really shines, because in the first half, she sort of plays the character we expect from her. And in the second half, she's someone that I've never really seen her play, and I didn't know she could play. I was much more taken with the second story, and I frankly would have enjoyed, I think, sort of just a longer movie of the second story, and I didn't really need the first half. I'm all for directors doing things a bit different, and certainly Black Bear does that. It's going to be a Black Bear, Black Bottom matchup to decide who goes to the lead eight.
Yeah, I'm going to vote for Black Bear again. Black Bear is a movie that I loved. It's in my top 10 for the year, so this is not really a close decision for me.
I like both movies, but I like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom more, and that's because this podcast frankly started when we got into an argument about Black Panther, and I said I don't understand the admiration for Black Panther. It just doesn't seem to me more than a superhero, an MCU movie. And Bozeman in particular, a little staid and a little sort of the quiet, you know, superhero. Talk about Plaza in Black Bear being someone else. I mean, I've never seen this sort of Chadwick Boseman. I didn't know, having seen him in several roles where he always plays the quiet, venerated, Defy Bloods type hero, the saintly figure. And in this movie, he's a live wire. He was absolutely magnetic. Ma Rainey is a very complex figure, and I think Viola Davis gives us that. And I don't think there's anything in Black Bear that touches those two characters. To me, it's an enthusiastic Ma Rainey's vote over Black Bear. And therefore, we have our last tiebreaker of the first two rounds.
I'm sending it to the group.
Way down south in Alabama, I got a friend they call Dancing Sam, who's crazy about all the latest dances. The other night at a swelled affair, soon as the boys found out that I was there, they said, come on, Ma, let's go to the cabaret. When I got there, they began to say, I want to
have a listener consensus, it seems, for Black Bear, showing the range of our listeners. So going into the lead eight from this corner is One Night in Miami and Black Bear.
Before we jump to our Elite Eight, can we share one more listener who nominated a movie that was not even in our bracket?
Let's do it.
So let's hear what Zach Brooks, the older of the Brooks, has to say.
Hello, There Will Be Pod. This is Zach.
And Brendan.
And we're the hosts of Ob's old podcast, The Movie Ladder Podcast. My favorite movie of the year was Palm Springs, but I'm sure other people picked that. So I'm going to ride for News of the World. It is the Western starring Tom Hanks, soon to be out, I believe, on Netflix this month. And it's just much better than it has any business being. It's not Oscar baity. It is just a nice, really good story that has some themes that apply to 2020 and the times that we're going through right now. And a really great story about companionship between Tom Hanks's character and the young character in that movie. So check out News of the World if you have not yet. I highly recommend it.
Did you see News of the World?
I did not. I think you told me not to, so I avoided
it. Oh, I haven't seen it yet.
Someone told me not to, so I went. Yeah,
yeah. I don't like Westerns. The four movies left we have on the left side of the bracket are Promising Young Woman, which will go up against Sound of Metal, and then Lover's Rock will go up against The Vast of Night.
And on my side, I have Nomadland going up against The Assistant, One Night in Miami going against Black Bear. Before we decide these finalists, let's hear what another listener had to say as their number one movie of the year.
I'm Travis.
I'm Sean.
I'm Chelsea.
From the Cinema Chop Shop podcast, a movie podcast that concedes that remakes are going to happen. So why shouldn't movie buffs
like us
decide who is recast in those iconic roles?
My favorite movie was Kajillionaire. This was directed by Miranda July, and it stars Evan Rachel Wood as the daughter of Deborah Winger and Richard Jenkins. They're con artists. They've trained her for 26 years. She's clearly sheltered, a little awkward. They kind of strike up this relationship with Gina Rodriguez, and it's such a sad story, but it has its charms, and it's just really interesting, and Evan Rachel Wood is such a good actress.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to what we had to say. Once again, we are Cinema Chop Shop.
Chelsea, thank you for suggesting that Kajillionaire was the best movie of the year. Again, did not even make it into our bracket. For that, we have my co-host Av to thank. Av encouraged me not to see the movie. So sorry, Chelsea, but at least one of the two co-hosts of the Will Be Pod disagrees with you.
Yeah. A lot of people really liked it. You could see it. You don't have to not see it just because I didn't like something.
I trust you enough that if you suggest it's not special, I'm not going to make a flex.
Okay, so welcome to Elite Eight. First matchup, we have Promising Young Woman, which previously defeated Hamilton, Trial of Chicago 7. It's had a real path here, no pushovers. Mm-hmm. And it will be going up against Sound of Metal, which defeated The Invisible Man, and Mogul Mowgli, which is the same exact movie as Sound of Metal, pretty much. You mentioned Adam Brody. One thing that Promising Young Woman did a great job of that we haven't really talked about is casting.
Yes.
Kind of like beloved sitcom people who are, you know, just were meant to see as nice guys, which is obviously a big chunk of the movie is. And it really does really well by taking Adam Brody or the guy who plays Schmidt on New Girl, Bo Burnham as well. Just like these guys that like you want to like. It uses your expectation of these characters. Use that like not that nice guy motif.
The movie really weaves so many different elements together from genre to music to setting. Really drive home a core social message, even in the casting. My vote is Promising Young Woman. You know, we're in the Elite Eight. All the options should be good by now.
I think one thing that is missing from Promising Young Woman is that I would have liked to see, like they do like the kind of the thing where she, you know, she lets a guy take her home with him and, you know, then she does her thing. And it does that twice in the movie. I think it would have been nice to see like a third time with like an actual nice guy. Not because like, I think, you know, there's been some criticism against this movie that like all the men in the movie are bad. And like, that's not fair because not all men, yada, yada, whatever. Fine. That's not a reasonable criticism to me. That's what the movie is. But I would have liked to see just like how she would have handled that situation, because presumably there will be some situations where she encounters where it turns out like when the moment comes, the guy says, oh, okay, you know, if you're really not up to it, then, you know, let me call you a cab and I can, you know, get you home. It would be nice to see her interplay with like different scenarios comes about. I could watch a 3-hour version of this movie, just like more time with this character and in different scenarios, I think would have been even more incredible. So Promising Young Woman is the win for me there. A final Elite Eight matchup on this side is Lover's Rock, which previously defeated The Five Bloods and The Platform, and it will go up against The Vast of Night, which defeated Another Round, followed by Dick Johnson is Dead.
This is the hardest matchup so far. I like both of these movies more than you, so I think that's why it's hard for me. You know, I think that's usually the case when one likes both movies strongly. It's hardest to choose between good and good. certain audio moments, particularly in the middle of The Best of Night, the silence is gripping and the audio noise is gripping. Interesting if Best of Night and Sound of Metal would have advanced and we would have had like an audio versus audio semifinale. But Lovers Rock, again, it has certain moments. It captured to me the magic of the movies in certain moments in Lovers Rock that I didn't get from anything else this year. Lovers Rock ultimately is my number one movie on my own list of the year. So I'm going to have to give the slightest edge to Lovers Rock.
Yeah, I'm going to vote for Lovers Rock as well. I just think that when push comes to shove, Lovers Rock is the much more memorable of the two. It's the one that, you know, 5-10 years from now, I will still probably, you know, a picture of it in my head. And it had a impact on me. It has an energy to it that I think, to your point, very few movies this year had. Vast of Night is very well made and very good, but ultimately forgettable in the long run. Lovers Rock gets the edge.
It is now forgettable because no one remembers the losers in the World Be Pod bracket. Let's see the other side, dun 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 da, of the Elite Eight. We have Nomadland, our number two overall seed, the highest ranked seed left, going up against The Assistant, which is the number 26 seed, which still boggles my mind. I mean, I saw The Assistant as the number one movie on a number of respected critics' end of the year, you know, rankings. And so I'm amazed that when you take all critics everywhere and average them together, The Assistant entered our tournament at number 26. Of course, it had to beat Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, Ob's number one overall, and also get past Mank. Ob, is this one of those cases, talking about real sports brackets, where the team that defeats your team, is that the horse you then want to ride all the way? If it beat my team, may it beat everyone's.
That's one way of looking at that. I think that's actually what happened to me last year with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I think it lost out to Portrait of a Lady on Fire in like the second round, which is very disappointing for me. And then it just went on to beat everybody from there. Although I think I voted against it every time because I didn't like it as much as you and Will did. But I think I am going to continue to ride The Assistant, much like the boss in this movie. I thought that The Assistant does a great job of never showing us the boss. He's like the shark in Jaws, who's just like looms over the entire movie. And we don't really know throughout the whole movie exactly what his deal is, exactly what he's doing wrong. But, you know, we could use our head a little bit. We have a pretty good idea what's going on in this place.
They give us the perfect amount. In Matt's vote for The Assistant, he mentioned this, which is beyond the Me Too element. Anyone who I think has worked in not the best work culture, double down and vote for The Assistant as well. Number 26 enters the final four. Who will it face? The contestants are One Night in Miami, which beat Bacurau and Minari, and it is going up against Black Bear. One of these is going into the final four.
Black Bear kind of like leaves some stuff on the table, which One Night in Miami is a complete story, I think gets the edge.
With Ma Rainey versus Black Bear, it was 2-1 in terms of great performances. With One Night in Miami, it's 4-1. Each of the leads manages to be really, really good. I mean, it's one of the best Malcolm X, apologies to Spike Lee and Denzel. It's one of the, you know, best Cassius Clay, less apologies perhaps to Will Smith. You know, each of them is just really good. Sam Cooke, someone I didn't know so well, is perhaps leaves the strongest impression. Personally, I actually like the Jim Brown the most. Has sort of the quietest role amongst the four, but he's such a presence, a physical presence, but also he's such a presence in sort of as the bridge between the other three real life characters. Yeah. One in Miami is going to go into the final four. Before we decide these final four finalists, let's see what Sean, co-host of Cinema Chop Shop, had to say about his number one movie of the year. Is it one of our four finalists? Sean, tell us what you think.
I'm Travis.
I'm Sean.
I'm Chelsea.
From the Cinema Chop Shop podcast, a movie podcast that concedes that remakes are going to happen. So why shouldn't movie buffs
like us
decide who's recast in those iconic roles?
My favorite movie of 2020 was Possessor.
Oh.
And this was the film directed by Brandon Cronenberg, son of David Cronenberg. And I picked this one because it came out early in 2020, and looking back, it still sticks with me. Some very disturbing images and a lot of really weird shit happens. Brandon is definitely keeping up the family tradition of body horror, the new flesh. So for that, I gave it really high marks. I know it's not the critically acclaimed greatest movie of 2020, but for me, it's the one that sticks out in my mind.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to what we had to say. Once again, we are Cinema Chop Shop.
It just seemed to me that Possessor was a Will movie, our late, great co-host. And therefore, when Will sort of, you know, couldn't join us anymore on the podcast, I felt I would just give Possessor a pass. Plus, I don't like horror movies. So I passed on it. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, I saw it. It didn't really leave me with much of an impression.
Assistant. It's going up against One Night in Miami. They're both in my top five for sure.
They're both in my top five as well.
The Assistant is the closest to a perfect movie in 2020 for me, meaning everything fits. One Night in Miami has flaws. The opening is a little bit slow. There's times when you're not really sure where the narrative is moving forward. You know, I'm not going to criticize One Night in Miami, but I am going to vote it down.
I mean, One Night in Miami is, to borrow the expression from the Game of Thrones discourse, it's just like the ultimate people talking in rooms movie. an absolutely high quality conversation. Like, they're talking about really, really important things. And the more you appreciate the real life versions of those characters, I think the more you're going to understand what's at stake. I mean, you have like a guy like Jim Brown, who has worked as hard as he could to get to where he is. And like, he's being basically confronted with like, well, you know, you need to now potentially risk throwing that all away because like, you need to look out for your people. And Sam Cooke is being challenged about similar things. I would put Malcolm X, played by Kingsley Benadire, as 4 out of 4, but he's amazing as well. And he brings ideas to the table and arguments to the table that are hard to just bat down. They've all brought it to this conversation.
Yeah.
And that's just like something that you don't always see. There's 4 different viewpoints based in 4 different real, fully formed people that have their viewpoints inspired by their own story and their own history in such a personal, intimate way. Really powerful to see that clash coming up against each other. The Assistant, it's not really about the conversation in the room, but it's about like the room itself. It's about this environment that has been created both by the toxic boss at the top and the people that go along with it. And, you know, probably mostly for their own survival, their own self-determination in terms of like keeping their job and advancing in their careers, kind of just like go with the flow rather than taking a stand. The fact that like so much of the evil that we face in the world comes from people kind of just like going with the flow and they don't necessarily have the courage or even the wherewithal to stand up against it is the cause of a lot of the problems that we have. And the Assistant just, I think, does a really great way of capturing that. It doesn't really make it about the boss. It doesn't even really make it about the assistant herself. She's kind of just like also just like trying to get through the day without taking advantage of. Really powerful to see those ideas up against each other. This is really close for me as well. I mean, they're both in my top five. I will go with the Assistant as well. It was more unexpected. One Night in Miami, I think expected it to be a great movie. The Assistant, I think I was just awestruck at it, just like how powerful I found it.
One of the only movies that I really just couldn't let me go in 2020. Something like Defy Bloods, which I had a great time with, but I could definitely pause Defy Bloods.
Assistant is going to face up against the winner of Lover's Rock and Promising Young Woman.
You could say Promising Young Woman starts almost in the venue where all of Lover's Rock takes place.
Normally, when we see like people dancing in a club, it's like focusing on like the women and like beautiful girls in beautiful outfits, very much male gazey. And this turns that on its head and it gives us the female gaze, but not the one-for-one comparison. Instead, it just like shows these guys as losers are there to pick up girls, don't really know what they're doing. They don't know how to dance. Like, it's not sexy at all. And I thought that was awesome.
Some of the camera movements of showing people dancing in Lover's Rock are really special, where guys slowly kind of guiding women onto the dance floor just by sort of very subtle movement, putting a hand on someone's hip in sort of a gentle way, like in a kind way. And there's also, there are aggressive assholes at Lover's Rock. The tension in this movie is one particular kind of guy that a woman doesn't want to have at a party where she's enjoying herself.
I wrote Lover's Rock, I think, about as far as I'm willing to take it. Promising Young Woman to me is the movie of the year, even though it wasn't my number one movie of the year.
Lover's Rock, most euphoric, my number one overall movie in my own ranking, set against Promising Young Woman in this bracket. After Promising Young Woman, there was just a lot more things I wanted to explore and follow up. So the fact that Lover's Rock is departing now is not to cast slander on my number one movie of the year. It's only to praise Promising Young Woman, which will go into the finals, but not before we hear from 2 final movies, which were nominated as number one. First, let's hear from Dr. Shai Chester, physicist, joined us earlier this year for
Palm Springs.
One that I did particularly like was The Painted Bird, which I actually did get to see in theaters here in Amsterdam. I thought it was a bit long, and I wasn't into all the episodes in its episodic structure, but a lot of them I did think were quite good, and I do think it captures the book quite well.
Sharp listeners may recall that last year at this time, Shai's number one movie of the year was a body horror movie set in Scandinavia, which also involves terrible things happening to a young man. If you recall which movie that was.
Midsommar. I see that this is a black and white movie in Czech. So we'll have to see about where on my list this goes.
Our last listener number one movie of the year comes from my brother's girlfriend. Figure they should be together.
Hi, my name is Aida. Favorite movie from 2020 is Spree, directed by Eugene Kotliarenko. previous film, Wobble Palace, is what acquainted me with this director. Spree is an insane movie about a social media addicted man who has a deadly plan to go viral. And I think it's a movie that incorporates very well the dispositifs of the cell phone, which is something I often see absent in movies, despite the large presence these technologies have in our life.
Aida last year suggested a movie that even Will, our noted horrorist, had never even heard of. It was a horror movie. This year, she suggests her number one movie of the year, another small indie horror movie called Spree. Had you heard of Spree in any context?
Not at all.
Let's put Painted Bird and Spree to the side and give some love to our finalists for the 2020 Movie Pod Best Movie.
Promising young woman going up against the assistant, and there's like lots of obvious parallels between these movies. They're both very female centered. They both obviously star a woman. They were both directed and written by women. They're both also about Me Too, obviously. What I think they both do a great job of showing is that the people like Harvey Weinstein, like rapists who do horrible things to women, are the most to blame for those things happening. Like, nobody is going to stand up and defend anything that they do. They're, you know, the worst perpetrators. But what I think both of them capture, which makes them so important, is that those predators would not be able to do what they do if not for a culture filled with enablers. Turn a blind eye, let these things continue. And whether it's Alison Brie's character in Promising Young Woman or the other people in the office and the assistant who just go along with what the boss is asking for.
The scene in the middle of Promising Young where she confronts the dean of the law school, there's certain parallels to the, in some ways, climactic scene in The Assistant where she confronts the HR officer.
Yeah.
And both the HR officer and the dean of the law school are supposed to, so to speak, be person in authority, supposed to set things right. And both of them just completely let down the main character. The two co-workers with Julie Garner's lead in The Assistant, they're promising young boys. They could have walked right into Promising Young Woman and they would be very in place. I could see them doing the sort of things that are skewed in Promising Young Woman.
And they're the type of guys that, much like the bad guys or the bad women in Promising Young Woman who, you know, don't do enough to stop what's going on, you understand how all of these people talk themselves into their own narrative that they are good guys. Whether it's because there's somebody else that's even worse. Don't look at me, like, I'm not the one doing this. Like, I just work at the office and I'm just punching my clock 9 to 5 and get through the day. The guys in, you know, McLovin and Adam Brody could probably talk themselves into believing that, like, you know, it's not like I raped someone. Like, listen, like, she drank too much and she came home with me and she knew what she was getting herself into, and like, this is what happens. We very much see that, like, all these guys walk away from these interactions, you know, believing in the justness of their own story and that, you know, they didn't really do anything wrong. The central theme that ties the characters in all these movies together, they're just kind of put into this position and they make a bad choice. They think that doesn't necessarily make them a bad person.
When the Weinstein bubble burst, so to speak, and the scandal was revealed and the extent to which he was so abusive to so many women, I recall there being like, oh, you know, big movies are going to be made about it. And The Assistant is a small movie. It's a modest movie. It's a quiet movie. And I don't think we need another movie per se, because I think The Assistant has done such a remarkable job. I think Kavanaugh is the promising young man. You know, he's the guy, oh, he messed around and he was in high school or prep school or whatever it was. But look at that. Since then, he's been an upstanding Catholic judge and he's supported young female jurists. And, you know, he goes back and speaks at his alma mater all the time. And, you know, what I pointed out in the previous episode is that I think the groom did the main crime in Promising Young Woman back when he was in college. I think the groom looks very, very similar to, frankly, what Kavanaugh looks like. You know, maybe the choice here between our two finalists, both of which are movies that I think we both were enthralled by, is, are you Team Kavanaugh or are you Team Weinstein?
I think I gotta opt out of that choice since I think either way I'm canceled. The phrase promising young man was used, that guy who, according to him, he like woke up on top of a girl and he was passed out.
The guy in Stanford, he was like captain of the swimming team or the water polo team.
Yes, I think so. He was referred to as a promising young man.
He was like a rich young white guy who, this is the kind of guy who society should be believing the woman. Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Promising a woman, though, I think there's like a couple of Joker homages. Her in that nurse costume towards the end very much parallels from the scene from The Dark Knight. I think one of the times where she's in the car ride home, she like sticks her head out the window, which I think was probably also a Joker nod.
And she's a figure of chaos. You know, the biggest difference between these two movies, with all the similarities you pointed out, The Assistant is has a much more realism vibe than Promising Woman. You know, Promising Woman has this sort of 90s poppy, you know you're in a movie feel to it, while the assistant documentary-esque in terms of the sense of realism that it captures. And therefore, I'm going to go with the assistant.
All right, well, I'm going to go with Promising Young Woman. When push comes to shove, I think Promising Young Woman was more entertaining. I think anyone who watches Promising Young Woman will like it, even if they don't love it. For me, Promising Young Woman is the movie that I will most remember about this year. It taps into the zeitgeist with more flair than The Assistant. The Assistant is much, much quieter.
It's very fitting that, you know, given we went into this bracket with only two judges, having lost our third judge along the way that was 2020, we managed to navigate through 33 plus movies without having a tiebreaker we couldn't break. What do you suggest? We're at an impasse.
Maybe we can force Will to see both of these movies and he can cast the tiebreaking vote.
I like. Listeners, we'll get back to you in 10 seconds podcast time and as much time as it takes Will.
A little longer than a few minutes later.
Da, 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 da. Dun, dun, dun. The suspense builds.
Should I tell him what he's voting on or should I just leave it?
Will, as many know, was the original co-host of this podcast. As a non-sports fan, he rode with us throughout 2019, our monthly episodes, of course, but he also rode through the 20 million sports movie brackets that we broke our teeth on. But 2020 threw challenges for all of us, and so Will had to drop out as our co-host. This is as good time as any while we wait for the decisive vote. We are looking for a dynamic third host. All you have to be is someone who's passionate about movies and particularly new releases and wants to join us once a month and talk new releases.
Okay, so we have our answer. Tiebreaker from Will.
The 2020 There Will Be Pod number one movie of the year is...
Promising Young Woman is one of my favorite movies of the past year. An all-time career high performance from Carey Mulligan, crossed with an unrelenting script portraying how badly one night can scar someone for life. It's a thought-provoking portrait on forgiveness and regret, challenging the viewer on where they ethically choose to draw the line. The final 20 minutes are what's going to make or break the movie for most viewers. I personally didn't love the way they took it. However, it was certainly a bold decision, and if nothing else, I expect it to keep people talking long into the new year. So with that, Promising Young Woman, best movie of 2020, sure.
Thank you, Will, for coming through and giving us that impassioned for why Promising Young Woman is not only the movie you favored over The Assistant, but by default is the number one movie of the year, according to their Will Be Pod.
Do we want to do like a rundown of our like top 10s?
Yeah.
My number 10 movie of the year is Sound of Metal. Number 9 is Black Bear. 8 is The Trial of the Chicago 7. 7 is Shithouse. And my number 6 is Hamilton.
My number 10 is The Vast of Night. My number 9 is Dick Johnson is Dead. 8 is Mogul Mowgli. As I said, it was up there for me. Number 7 is Promising Young Woman, the number one movie of the year. And my number 6 is Ma Rainey's Black Bottom.
Oh, wow. You were really high on that.
My number 5 is Archive.
My number 5 is Palm Springs.
My number 4 is The Wild Goose Lake, the Chinese language gangster movie set in Wuhan.
My number 4 is One Night in Miami, set in Miami.
My number 3 is One Night in Miami.
My number 3 is The Assistant.
My number 2 is The Assistant.
My number 2 is Promising Young Woman.
Okay, I knew that was, it had to be up there somewhere for you. Our number one movies of the year were?
Never,
Lovers,
Rarely,
Rock.
Sometimes, Always.
That's it for 2020. There Will Be Pod will be back in your eardrums, hopefully. But we are looking for another dynamic voice.
If you're at all interested, Twitter direct message to one of us. You could send us a WhatsApp message or an email.
Looking ahead to 2021, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the most memorable movie experience I had in the past year, which was...
Right around the time when The Five Bloods came out, you can find it on the same episode, we did a most impactful movies that engage with police violence against African-Americans. And seeing those, you know, 15, 20 movies in the space of 2 weeks together with The Five Bloods, I think when people say, what can we take from truth with the rise of social media and bubbles and the movies of 2020 and the movies we're going to have in the future, they do communicate a truth about our social experience that does influence a lot of people, and I think for the better. And therefore, I'm excited to see what 2020 will inspire for future movie makers.
Hopefully, 2021 will be a year where things return to normal, some sense of normalcy in society at large, in the workplace, and hopefully the reopening of movie theaters on some sort of large scale.
And if that happens, there will be pod.
There will be pod either way, I hope. There will be pod.
It's been years. Still got tears. I carry on, but I don't.
don't keep calm. No. You forgot. You forgot. I did not. She did not. I got a sick obsession. I need to see it through. Uh-oh.